You're listening to TalkTainmentRadio.com.
The views and opinions expressed are those of the host and guest and not necessarily those of TalkTainmentRadio.com, the management, the staff, or K&E World Network, LLC.
Point West with Bobby West. Heard exclusively on TalkTainmentRadio.com. Radio, the way it should be heard. Point West, West.
Okay, welcome to the second hour of Point West. This one we're going to do is the Dred Scott decision. And what you need to know about the Dred Scott decision, as we try to cue it up. It's about almost 50 minutes long, but it's very good and informative information, and what happened and how it affects us even today, especially with the Supreme Court Judge Taney and his ruling, arguably the worst decision that the Supreme Court has ever made, according to the people who have researched this. Now, did you know anything about Dred Scott, or do you care? Well, you should. Dred Scott and how it affects you even today, that decision and what he did and what he had to go through, endure as a black man. So what we're going to do as they cue it up, you're going to hear some things like that, hear some things about that. And at the end, if we have any space left, we will, entertain some questions that if you want. So get ready. You can call at 1-877-932-9766, or you can Gmail me at the,
one of the most important
at numeral 7, Mr. Bobby,
one of the most important at gmail.com. In American history, and it's the Supreme Court's decision.
Alrighty, we're getting ready to go right to it. The Dred Scott decision.
Versus
there
Sanford, better known as the Dred Scott case. I mean, I'm a law professor, okay? I also happen to teach constitutional law, so there are very few things that give me as much joy as talking about cases like this. Now, before I launch into things, though, I do want to thank Paul Mills and the D.C. Public Library for inviting me to speak. I'm of the view that cases like Dred Scott are meant of the Dred Scott case, as well as its contemporary relevance. Right? And that's one of these things, right? You know, I said contemporary relevance because I'm of the view that cases like the Dred Scott case are really at their core about the human condition, right? The Dred Scott case, I think, forced us to consider what it truly meant to say that we are a society in which all men are created equal, where we're supposed to be treating each other with equal dignity, where we're supposed to presume that each of us possesses equal humanity. And what are the consequences when we fail to do so? It's been over 150 years since the Dred Scott case has been decided, and we continue to struggle with these fundamental issues. Think about it. Perhaps now, more than in any period in recent history, we live in a period of elevated racial and ethnic tension, despite having a black president. Think about it. We bear witness to the almost ritualistic destruction of black bodies by law enforcement officers in urban areas. We see escalating hostility and profiling of Latinos on our southern border. And we see increased animus directed at Arab and Muslim Americans all over the country. What do these fundamental ideals of equal humanity and equal dignity mean today? These are issues that were raised by the Scots. But what do they mean for us today in these contentious times? Perhaps we can look at the Dred Scott decision and the events surrounding the Dred Scott decision for some wisdom, some insight, and hopefully a little bit of inspiration. Okay? Now, for the uninitiated, you should know from the outset that Scott versus Sanford is one of the most significant cases ever decided by the United States Supreme Court. It is also, as Paul said earlier, one of the most infamous. It's a case that I think encapsulates a rich array of conflicting and confrontational impulses. We're going to talk a little bit about that. But first and foremost, I want you to know that the Dred Scott case is an inspiring story about a black American family. Dred and Harriet Scott and their two daughters, Eliza and Lizzie, and their tenacious, decade-long pursuit of human dignity and respect in the face of systemic, institutionalized racial injustice. It's also a window, I think, into the complexity of 19th century race relations between whites and blacks, between slaves and masters, between elite legal actors and everyday people. And that's why I say, fundamentally, we need to understand the Dred Scott decision as shedding light on the human condition. Dred Scott is also a showcase for, I think, some of the most arrogant racist views ever articulated by 19th century legal actors. And I'm speaking about Chief Justice Roger Taney of the United States Supreme Court, whose majority opinion in this case has been roundly condemned by just about everyone, right, as a dangerous exercise of judicial activism, and in the words of Frederick Douglass, a brazen misstatement of history.
You're listening to... We'll talk a little bit about that. Point
the
West
status
here
of
on
slavery
Talktainment Radio
in American life,
we are discussing
was perhaps the single most contentious
the Dred Scott decision
and divisive political
in particular
issue
the,
in the middle part
Scott
of the 19th century when the Dred Scott case is coming to fruition.
What it did when it
the
came
Supreme
up,
Court,
you know, to
Justice
the Supreme
Taney,
Court,
they
with
thought
Justice,
that they could snatch
Taney,
that issue away
Taney,
from the public,
whichever way you want to
and
say
as
it.
A court decided
and the bad
once
things
and for
that
all,
happened
for all people,
to this man and his family at least
that it just doesn't work like that.
I want to say maybe 12 years.
Years any
going through that
views.
And how he was
it fomented resistance and it added fuel to the spark
free
that
man,
would eventually ignite a civil
the
war
racial
which
climate would not allow
of a
Mr.
million
Scott
men lost their lives
to celebrate his
the
freedom
bloodiest,
so whatever happened to all men
American
are created
history.
Equal and are endowed
so for this
by
reason,
their freedom
I think
with certain
the Dred Scott
inalienable rights
enjoys the distinction
and among these
of being
are
perhaps the
under the right to life liberty and the pursuit of happiness
ever
rendered. But not if you're black.
It is what I've called in
that's just the way that it was.
The ultimate anti-presidential
that's just the way
case.
That it was.
It is a master lesson
okay.
in terms
well,
of
I think we're
going to
return to
and society
the
should not
lecture
do.
That's going on.
All right. Okay, so now there's a lot to talk about when we talk about Dred Scott. But I'm going to limit my comments to just four things today so that we can have a conversation afterwards. All right. First, I want to tell you the story about the lives of the people who brought about this case, who gave birth to this case. Law has a tendency towards abstraction. What I want to do is humanize this case for you, give you a sense of who Dred and Harriet were and who were the other players involved in this particular decision. Second, I also want to provide an explanation of the court's decision and why I say it's the worst decision in Supreme Court history. Right? I want to help you understand why that's the case. Third, I want to talk a little bit about the aftermath of the decision. What happened to the Scots? What happened to our world? And then finally, I want to close with what I think are some lessons that we can draw from the events surrounding the Dred Scott case that have ongoing significance and contemporary relevance to conversations today about racial justice. Okay, so that's the roadmap. Let's start with the story, okay? How does this case come about? It begins with a guy named Dred Scott. Dred Scott, he's born around 1800. We don't know his exact birth date because back then, if you were a slave, oftentimes we didn't keep a record of when you were born. So what we think is that he was born roughly in the 1800s, sometime in the 1800s. We know that he was born in the Hampton Roads area of Virginia. He was the slave to a man by the name of Peter Blow, whose wife's name was Elizabeth Taylor Blow. And Dred was a typical slave, okay, meaning that he was a farmhand, but he was a skilled farmhand. He knew how to handle horses and do some other kinds of things, okay? In any case, in 1818, Peter Blow decides to move his family and Dred, right, because Dred's his slave, to Alabama because he had just bought a cotton plantation. And he thought he was going to go down there and grow cotton. That didn't go so well for the Blow family. So they decided to sell the cotton plantation and move to St. Louis, Missouri, where the Blow family bought basically a boarding house called the Jefferson Hotel. All right? By this time, it's 1830. All right? Now, if Dred is born in 1800, that means he's 30 years old. He's no longer a young man, okay? And so that means now we see Dred less of a farmhand, more of a personal valet, a body man. That's the role that Dred has taken on. Peter's wife, Elizabeth, dies in 1830, and Peter would die in 1832. But before he dies, he makes an arrangement with a guy by the name of Dr. Emerson for the sale of Dred Scott. He's going to sell Dred Scott to Dr. Emerson to be his valet or body man, okay? Now, this is where things start to get interesting in the story, right? Because slaves get bought and sold all the time. But Dr. Emerson is a single man, number one, and he's an army physician, number two, which means he's going to be moving around. He's being stationed at a lot of different places, not just in the slave state of Missouri. And it turns out that Dr. Emerson's first assignment is at Fort Armstrong. Does anyone know where Fort Armstrong was located back then? Nah, right? It is in Rock Island, Illinois, right? Rock Island, Illinois is where Fort Armstrong's located. Illinois is a free state, okay? His second posting would take him to Fort Snelling. Fort Snelling was in what was then called the Wisconsin Territory, what we call Minnesota today, okay? That's also free territory. Okay, now here's where it gets interesting, right? Because under both federal law and state law at the time, Dred would have lost his slave status the minute he stepped foot into free territory. There was a doctrine associated with this. It was called extraterritorial emancipation. Everybody knew that that was the law. Nevertheless, Dred remains nominally Dr. Emerson's slave, even though he's in free territory. But Dred's not your normal slave, okay? For instance, when they're at Fort Snelling, up there in the Wisconsin Territory, Minnesota, Dr. Emerson has to travel around the country on his own by himself, and he doesn't always want to take Dred with him. So Dred stays back at Fort Snelling, but he's a body man, and his guy is gone. So what does he do? He hires himself out to help other people at Fort Snelling. But he keeps the money. He doesn't give the money to his master. It's his money. He's raising money for himself. In addition, in 1837, Dred meets Harriet Robinson. Harriet Robinson is a slave that's owned by Major Tolliver, okay, who is also stationed at Fort Snelling and also just happens to be a justice of the peace. Turns out Harriet's like 15 years younger, but they still fall in love. They decide to get married later that year. And Major Tolliver conducts the wedding ceremony. Now, let's just pause on this. Two slaves getting married? Marriage is a right, and it's also a contractual legal status. Slaves didn't have rights. Slaves couldn't enter into enforceable contracts. Yet Dred and Harriet got married. What's going on here? Now see, here's the thing. We don't have clear records on this either, but I get the sense that what happened was Major Tolliver transferred title of Harriet to Dr. Emerson, conducted the ceremony as window dressing. It was a simple slave transaction, but I think it's indicative that there's something unique about Dred Scott and his relationship with his master. They have an understanding. He's enjoying certain liberties that other slaves couldn't enjoy. He's earning money for himself. He's getting married to a woman of his choosing. In any event, things start to get complicated, as they always do. A year later, after Dred and Harriet get married, Dr. Emerson decides to marry a woman named Eliza Irene Sanford of St. Louis. Okay, Sanford, that's the name, right? Okay, now, the four of them settle down in free territory. This is Eliza and Eliza and Dr. Emerson, Dred and Harriet, the four of them living in free territory. And everything's cool at first between Dred and Harriet and the new Mrs. Emerson. In fact, Dred and Harriet named their first daughter after the new Mrs. Emerson, right? Eliza Irene Sanford, Eliza Irene Emerson now, right? And again, Eliza's born in free territory. So, under prevailing federal and state law, she would have been a free person, okay? But she's being nominally held as a slave. Dr. Emerson starts getting transferred a lot of different places again. So the Scotts and Mrs. Emerson return to St. Louis, Missouri to live on Mrs. Emerson's father's estate, okay? Dr. Emerson eventually dies in 1943, and he leaves his entire estate, including the Scotts, to Mrs. Emerson. All right? Now, again, the relationship is starting to, you know, fracture a little bit. 3 years later, after Dr. Emerson has died, Mrs. Emerson thinks that maybe she should be making a little money off of Dredd. Okay, now remember, this is 1946 we're talking now, right? Or 1846, right? I move across these centuries so often, right? 1846. Yes, it's 1846. So that means Dredd is 46 years old. Okay? And she wants to hire him out to a guy by the name of Samuel Russell to work. Now remember, Dredd is not your ordinary slave. He'd been earning money on his own in Fort Snelling. He'd actually been earning money on his own while he was in St. Louis. So he says to Mrs. Emerson, hey, look, if you need money, here's something. How about I buy my own freedom? I buy Harriet's freedom. I buy Eliza's freedom. And I buy Lizzie's freedom, because by now he's had a second daughter. Right? He says, I'm willing to buy all this. And she says, no. So what does Dredd do? Dredd decides to file a lawsuit claiming false imprisonment, that he and his family are being falsely imprisoned, held against their will by Mrs. Emerson. Now, you might be thinking, filing a lawsuit against your purported master? That's brave. That is something. You got it, right? That's special. But as it turned out, freedom suits of this nature were actually not that uncommon, particularly in border states like Missouri, where the slavery question was disputed, where everybody wasn't necessarily in agreement that slavery was good or slavery was bad, right? So these suits weren't particularly ideological. They weren't part of the abolitionist movement, per se. It was sort of like workaday litigation, cases that had to be dealt with, issues that had to be resolved. Wasn't always the prettiest stuff, but it had to be done. Think of it like criminal defense work. Right? There are criminal cases, and those cases need to be resolved. And, you know, some people have strong views about criminality one way or the other, but they're lawyers that try the cases. I used to try them. It was just my job, right? There were some 300 of these freedom suits filed in the state of Missouri at that time, just to give you a sense of just how common they were. Now, when most people think of the Dred Scott decision, they think of the Supreme Court case, right? The one that Justice Taney wrote that infamous opinion on, and that's the big one, that's right. But you don't start your case in the Supreme Court. You don't file a case in the Supreme Court. You gotta file someplace else and eventually appeal your way up to the Supreme Court if the Supreme Court is willing to hear your case. And this was a complicated piece of litigation. It actually starts in state court. And it's only after that gets exhausted that we get a case that's filed in federal court. I'll tell you about that in a minute. But let's start with the state court litigation, because that's where the story really begins. And there's some interesting facts that you may or may not fully appreciate. For instance, does anyone know who paid for Dred Scott's lawyer's fees, legal fees, right? Because you got to pay for a lawsuit. You think Dred Scott paid for it? He's working, but he's not paying for his own lawsuit. There's somebody else paying. The children of Peter and Elizabeth Taylor Blow, Dred Scott's original master. The children, the ones who grew up with Dred, remember? He was a young man born in 1800, becomes a teenager. They were teenagers too. Charlotte, the daughter of Peter Blow, marries the editor of an abolitionist newspaper. One of the sons becomes a Republican congressman. One of the daughters, another daughter, marries a Republican senator. They've all remained in contact with Dred Scott. They've all become abolitionists. Collectively, that family decides to sign a security and finance the decade-long litigation effort on behalf of the Scotts. Another surprising fact, which a lot of people didn't fully appreciate, was that the law was on Dred Scott's side at the time. Years earlier, the Missouri Supreme Court, the highest court in the state of Missouri, had decided a case by the name of Rachel versus Walker. Nobody ever talks about Rachel versus Walker. It's a case in which that court held that an army officer forfeited his slave if he took that slave to territory where slavery was prohibited. Sound familiar? That's extraterritorial emancipation doctrine, right? That's what it is. And that's almost exactly what happened with Dred Scott. Okay. So Dred files the first case. That case ends on a technicality. I can explain why it ended on the technicality. But what's important is that he refiles the case. And on the retrial of the case, Dred Scott actually wins. A jury of 12 white men found that Dred, Harriet, and their two children were falsely held as slaves and they should be freed immediately. Nevertheless, Mrs. Emerson appeals. She wants to press forward with this litigation. She appeals that decision. Now, a lot of people say, well, why would she do that? I mean, why would she continue to press the issue? The law was clearly on Dred Scott's side. And in any event, Dred and Harriet are now in their 40s. And we're talking about in the 19th century when you're in your 40s. It's different than being in your 40s like now, right? If you were in your 40s, you were sort of on the trailing edge of things, right? Now it's middle age, right? Okay, so they're in their 40s. They have diminished value on the slave market. They're not valuable slaves anymore. They're almost liabilities because you still have to care and feed them. And you're not getting as much productivity out of them. So why press the issue? Why continue to try to hold Dred Scott as a slave? So there are two theories that have been put forward. The first relates to Mrs. Emerson's brother, John Sanford, right? That's where the lawsuit Scott versus Sanford is going to come from, right? I'll explain that in a couple of minutes, right? So anyway, Mrs. Emerson would eventually transfer title to Dred and Harriet and the children to her brother, John Sanford, okay? That's going to happen later on. At the time of the filing of the state suit, right, and the appeal of the state lawsuit, that transfer had only just begun. John, her brother, John Sanford, used to be married to the daughter of a guy by the name of Pierre Choteau, who was a wealthy, slave-owning St. Louis businessman. Okay? John Sanford had substantial ties with the Choteau family and the Choteau business. And so the theory was that John was putting pressure on his sister to maintain this litigation in an effort to protect and expand the institution of slavery more generally and protect the Choteau family wealth and his business assets. So it really wasn't about Dred Scott per se. Okay, that's one theory. The second theory, which in my view is more compelling and is also backed up with more anecdotal evidence, was that the case was not really about Dred and Harriet Scott. Because again, we're talking about older slaves of diminished market value in the slave market. They have two daughters, Eliza and Lizzie, young girls at the time. The transatlantic slave trade had stopped 40 years earlier. So you were no longer importing new slaves. Slave women were the sole means through which one could expand one's slave portfolio. Those daughters were priceless. So some have said that the reason why this litigation continued was not because of the value of Dred and Harriet, but the value of Lizzie and Eliza. If they could be held in slavery, that could be financially remunerative. There's no surprise then learning that the daughters were held in a secured location throughout the entire decade of litigation. Okay. So, in any event, Mrs. Emerson and her brother appealed the decision all the way up to the Missouri Supreme Court, the same court that had previously upheld the emancipation of a different slave under similar circumstances. But this time, the court changes direction. In a surprising opinion, the Missouri State Supreme Court would reject its own precedent and reverse Dred Scott's hard-fought victory. So the Scots are now back to square one. The court has declared them slaves again. In the meantime, Mrs. Emerson has remarried a Republican congressman by the name of Calvin Chafee. He's from Massachusetts. He's an abolitionist. Uh-oh, because she's got those slaves as part of her estate. So she completes the transfer of title of the Scotts to her brother John Sanford. Sanford is a resident of New York. He's got those business ties in St. Louis to the Choteau family, but he lives in New York. Now, Dred Scott is in Missouri. Sanford is from New York. His lawyers say, we could appeal the Supreme Court decision, the Missouri Supreme Court decision, to the United States Supreme Court, or now, because we have what's called diversity of citizenship, we have citizens from two different states, they are allowed to file lawsuits directly in federal court, and you can start all over again. And so his lawyers say, that's what we're going to do. What Dred Scott does is he refiles that freedom suit, the same false imprisonment suit, this time against John Sanford, Scott versus Sanford, in federal court. And that's the case that eventually gets appealed up to the United States Supreme Court. But it's basically the same lawsuit, just in federal court. Okay, now, let's talk about the Supreme Court case for a little bit, because there's some interesting details here. First, the composition of the court. What did the court look like? Right, we're talking about late 19th century, right? What does the Supreme Court look like? Can you imagine this? If you're Dred Scott, seven of the nine justices on the court were acknowledged pro-slavery Democrats. Seven have already said, we support slavery. We're all about slavery, maintaining it. Five of the nine justices descended from prominent slaveholding families. So they grew up with slavery. They were invested in slavery. Only two of the justices, Justice Curtis, who's a Whig, and Justice McLean, a Republican, were anti-slavery. Two. So talk about a hostile judiciary. I mean, they were facing a hostile judiciary there. Second, it's worth noting that the case was argued not once, but twice before the Supreme Court. They had to re-argue it. And not in that nice Supreme Court building that you see up there now. Back then, the Supreme Court used to meet in the basement of the Capitol building. So you had to go underground. It was not a nice place to be. But they argued the case twice. And in the second argument, Dred Scott was actually represented by Montgomery Blair and a guy by the name of George Curtis. Now, that name Curtis should sound familiar because I just said one of the justices was Justice Curtis, and he was a Whig. That's Benjamin Curtis. That's George's brother. So Dred Scott's lawyer hired one of the sitting Supreme Court justices' brothers to argue his side of the case. That would seem like a rather obvious effort to curry favor with a sitting justice. We would call that a conflict of interest today. Back then, it was just doing business. Now, you might ask yourself, well, why would Montgomery Blair, who was Dred Scott's lawyer, feel the need to do that, to try to curry favor? Well, it turns out that there was reason to suspect that the same thing was happening on the other side of the case. Indeed, there's evidence to suggest that there was possible presidential tampering. President-elect James Buchanan was supported by pro-slavery constituencies, and he felt that his mandate was to restrain the abolitionist. He wrote letters indicating his attempt to try to influence the vote of not one, but two sitting justices, Justice Catron and Justice Greer. And that's just a fact. And finally, something to note from the outset is that although Chief Justice Roger Taney's opinion gets all the attention, this is one of the rare Supreme Court cases in which each justice wrote a separate opinion about the case. So it was really important. They all felt like they needed to say what they needed to say. But it was Justice Taney whose opinion really sort of takes the cake. And that's really why it's so infamous of a decision, right? I mean, what makes this case so infamous? It is precisely Justice Taney's majority opinion in which he attempts to rewrite history as we know it. Remember, as I said, this is a federal case. It's about false imprisonment, right? Scots being held as slaves. The ability to sue in federal court turns on whether or not Dred is a citizen within the meaning of the Constitution. He has to be a citizen of the state of Missouri in order to file a lawsuit against this citizen in New York in federal court. Okay? So the issue is what we call a jurisdictional.
Pause here in this case here on Talk Tim at Radio Point West for these commercial messages. Thanks for listening.
Maybe we'll fire the landlord. This next song is dedicated to all the cool cats and...
Attention Central Ohio.
Stand by for an important message.
Someone once said, these times like all times are good times if we just know what to do. Linco Realty says this is the best time to buy or sell a home, because interest rates are the lowest in history. Linco Realty has been providing real estate services for over 40 years in Central Ohio. Let us help you fire your landlord. If you have questions on pre-approvals, credit scores, down payments, financing, down payment assistance programs, schools, or other real estate questions, go to LincoRealty.com or call us at 614-375-2289. Again, 614-375-2BUY. Fire your landlord. Call us at 614-375-2289. Check out LincoRealty.com, then start packing.
The Glory Soul Food Cafe, a taste of Southern classic, located at 3350 Allegheny Avenue in Columbus, Ohio. For carryout, call 614-237-5844 or go to DoorDash.com. Soul food specials on Wednesdays. Get the menu at LaGloriesCafe.com for the best eating in town.
That's LaGlory Soul Food Cafe, 3350 Allegheny Avenue, Columbus, Ohio. For carryout, dial 614-237-5844 or go to DoorDash.com.
Sex Code War by Kahari Inaharo, the author of the Essence magazine bestseller Race Code War, is releasing his second book, Sex Code War. Be on the lookout for Sex Code War.
Supporting minority education. I'm Sean Booker, damn it. I'm here to tell you that as the mother of a high school senior, I know due to financial circumstances, many of America's deserving minority students do not have access to a college education. Since 1944, the United Negro College Fund has sought to provide one. Since 1972, the beginning of this campaign, UNCF has helped more than 300,000 talented students earn a college degree. I'm Sean Booker, damn it. Give a helping hand.
Here's an idea. You've heard of the notion of pay it forward. It comes from the 2000 movie Pay It Forward. Basically, the premise is helping someone with no expectations of payback, providing assistance to someone, passing information on, simply doing a good deed for a total stranger, and instead of allowing them to pay it back, ask them to pay it forward. Doing favors for other people and asking them to do the same. The principle is the same as multi-level marketing, except that instead of soap or vitamins, it's generosity between strangers that is being passed on. Pay It Forward is mentoring. It's volunteering in your community. It's shoveling a neighbor's snow or cutting an elderly person's grass for them or taking a senior to the store. Don't wait for someone else to do something good. Do it yourself. It starts with you. Talktainment Radio strongly embraces the notion of pay it forward. In fact, we just did.
My name is Al Edmondson. I'm a business owner and community organizer. I want to encourage you to visit the King Lincoln District, our community. It's a great place to live, work, and worship. Catch a show at the Lincoln Theater. Enjoy smooth jazz at the King Arts Complex. Enjoy great food and visit our historical churches and newly remodeled homes. Live, work, and worship the King Lincoln District.
Goodwill is a global social services enterprise and the leading nonprofit provider of job training programs and career services in the United States and Canada. To pay for its program, Goodwill sells donated clothes and other household items in more than 2,700 stores and online at shopgoodwill.com. Goodwill uses the revenue earned from these sales to fund job training, employment placement services, and other community programs. The goal of the campaign is to increase goods donations to Goodwill, inspire an emotional connection to the Goodwill brand, and to elevate preference for Goodwill. Will.
At TalkTainmentRadio.com, we don't just talk, we don't just entertain. We've combined talk radio with the latest in online entertainment, with the ability to listen live at no cost 24/7. We are the premier online radio station. Outperforming the digital quality of our competitors, our shows are produced in a state-of-the-art studio by the best radio professionals in the business. Hosting live shows on location at some of the area's greatest and most popular events, we give you exactly what you want to hear with talk radio that matters to you. Join us online at TalkTainmentRadio.com, where you can listen live or play podcasts from the best shows in online talk radio. We give you a reason to come. We give you a reason to stay. TalkTainmentRadio.com. Radio, the way it should be heard.
You've got the power.
You are the power.
Right here on TalkTainment Radio.
Okay. Now we are going to return to the conclusion of the Dred Scott decision. Here on TalkTainmentRadio.com, the show is called Point West. As soon as we get that bad boy queued up again, you'll hear the conclusion of it on the Dred Scott decision, what you should know concerning that. And we try to bring programming that we feel is informative and that you would know the story behind the story. And this is one that even affects us today, the Dred Scott decision. So as soon as we get that queued to where it's supposed to be, we'll get it on the screen and art for your ears, so to speak. As, there you go. All righty.
Could become citizens. That's what he said. Okay? Therefore, Dred Scott has no standing to bring his case in federal court. The court lacked jurisdiction. That's why Dred Scott, Harriet, and the kids remain slaves. All right? That's what he says. Now, here's where it gets a little dicey. It gets dicey when he tries to explain why it is that blacks were never citizens, never could become citizens. Because Justice Taney didn't ask simply whether or not Dred Scott was a citizen. That's a status question, right? What's his status? Is he a citizen or not? Right? That's not what he asks. He frames it in a slightly more provocative way. This is what Justice Taney said. Justice Taney put it this way, quote, "Can a Negro whose ancestors were imported to this country and sold as slaves become a member of the political community formed and brought into existence by the Constitution of the United States?" Now, I quote that language because it's important. Member of the political community. He didn't say whether you're a citizen. He said, are you a member of this political community? Now, why do you think he used the word community? I think he uses the word community because when we think about community, it invokes a greater sense of personal intimacy, right? Communities are like people. We sort of know what a community is. Citizens, well, hell, everybody's a citizen, right? Lots of citizens, right? We don't really view citizenship as the same kinship as a community, right? Okay, so why? Well, hell, everybody's a citizen, right? Lots of citizens, right? We don't really view citizenship as the same kinship as a community, right? Okay, so why couldn't Negroes be part of the community? He said it's because Negroes were inferior. It's because they were unfit to associate with whites. That's what he said. And he has a famous line in there that, you know, Negroes have no rights that the white man is bound to respect, end quote. Right? That's what he said. But he went on. There was more to it than that. He said, look, this is not my opinion. He says this is, quote, fixed and universal in the civilized portion of the white race, end quote. He said it's an axiom in morals and in politics that no one even doubted, and that the framers of the Constitution, what he called great men, high in literary accomplishment, they knew this too. And he said it was true at the time of the Declaration of Independence, that there was a strong sentiment out there that blacks were not part of the community, right? That's what he says. But now, you got to pause on that for a moment and ask yourself, are those legal arguments? Does that sound like law to you? Is he quoting any law? Is he citing any rule? Has there been a case mentioned? No. Taney's decision didn't rest on law. It rested on emotion, attitudes, assumptions, and beliefs about people, sure. Racism, yep. Sentiment, surely, but not reason. No legal reasoning there. He seems to have forgotten, and this is the big pieces. He forgot what he was doing. He forgot that he was writing a legal opinion on behalf of a court of law, and instead must have thought he was writing a pro-slavery nationalist manifesto. Because it works for that audience, doesn't really work for lawyers. But that's not the only error he made, right? The other one has to do with jurisdiction. Remember, I gave you jurisdiction 101, right? When a court does not have jurisdiction over a case, there's nothing to be decided, right? Court can't do anything if it doesn't have jurisdiction. What happened in this case? The court says Dred Scott's not a citizen, so we don't have jurisdiction to decide the case. Except there's that issue of whether or not Congress can prohibit slavery in free territories. That's part of this case. We're going to go ahead and invalidate the Missouri Compromise. We're going to go ahead and say that Congress acted unconstitutionally when it tried to prohibit slavery in the territories where Dred Scott traveled. It's the first time in Supreme Court history where the court strikes down a piece of federal legislation. Just think about that. The first piece of federal legislation ever struck down by our Supreme Court where Dred Scott traveled. It's the first time in Supreme Court history where the court strikes down a piece of federal legislation. Just think about that. The first piece of federal legislation ever struck down by our Supreme Court strikes down a piece of federal legislation. That's the Missouri Compromise, right, of 1820. That's the Missouri Compromise. So here you have the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court not only disposing of Dred Scott's case based upon non-legal arguments, but then deciding the merits of an issue raised by that case right after it just said it didn't have jurisdiction to decide the case. Question. If the court had decided that he was a citizen, then they would have had the option of enforcing Missouri law or substituting their own law. But once they decided that Dred Scott was not a citizen, they didn't need to decide the Missouri Compromise. They didn't need to do anything. They could have just said, that's it. Cases, we don't have jurisdiction to hear it. The pre-existing ruling, which held that Dred Scott was a slave, would be the final decision. And that would have been the end of it, right? So this is pretty remarkable stuff, right? And it's pretty flagrant, frankly. And much of it might not have gone unnoticed, but for the fact that you've got Justice Curtis and Justice McLean also writing dissenting opinions on the court, pointing out the obvious errors here. Now, McLean's dissent was very technical. Justice Curtis's was devastatingly effective, but they were very similar. Just one was more technical, one was more rhetorically effective. What Curtis and McLean were saying was, hold on, Justice Taney. You say that blacks could never be citizens. Then how do you explain the fact that there were free blacks in the North and in the South who were basically exercising the rights of citizens at the time that the Constitution was ratified? How do you explain that? The problem, and this is something that Justice Curtis points out, he said the problem is that Taney forgot that not all blacks were slaves. He's thinking slaves, but there were free blacks in the North and in the South. And those that were not enslaved could be citizens of the several states. And under United States law, the Constitution, right, as defined by the Constitution, citizens are any people who were citizens of the several states at the time of ratification. So within the meaning of the Constitution, if you were a citizen of the several states, you were a citizen for constitutional purposes and for purposes of filing a lawsuit. Okay? Now, we know that these people existed. You want to know why? Let me give you an example. How many of you have heard of Denmark Vesey? Who's Denmark Vesey? Who's Denmark Vesey? Charleston, South Carolina, right? He didn't help found it. There's another guy who helped found a church, but he was down. He started the slave revolt. Right, he started a slave revolt. Okay, so Denmark Vesey, he was stirring the pot, right, down in Charleston, South Carolina. They thwarted the slave revolt, okay, before anything bad happened, but it scared people in South Carolina because the majority of people in South Carolina at the time were slaves. Okay, the majority. So they cracked down. Right? After that rebellion was thwarted, South Carolina passed something called the Negro Seamen's Act.
It was the same church where the parishioners.
Yep, exactly. That's right.
That's where Ruth went there.
Mother Emanuel, that's right. So the Negro Seamen's Act was passed by South Carolina. And what it was a law that required free blacks who were on board of ships that drew into port in Charleston, South Carolina, Free blacks had to remain incarcerated on the ships until the ship left port. And the reason why is they didn't want any outside agitators coming in to Charleston stirring things up, right? No more Denmark Vesey kind of stuff, right? But here's what happened. The state of Massachusetts challenges that law in court, saying that it can't have citizens of Massachusetts incarcerated simply because their boat pulls up to a dock in South Carolina. That would violate the privileges and immunities clause that are designed to protect the privileges and immunities of citizens of the several states. The only citizens who could be locked up in South Carolina under the Negro Seamen's Act are free blacks. So we know there were free black citizens. We know they existed. Now, South Carolina defended this challenge and said, forget you. Have you ever heard of Denmark Vesey? Right? But they also said, you know, look, the reality is we're treating this like a quarantine. And quarantines can be applied to all citizens, usually for illness, right? If you're sick or something, they can quarantine you, right? And it's not a violation of your privileges and immunities. But the point was made. The point was that it was far from universally thought that blacks were not citizens. In fact, South Carolina's position necessarily recognized free blacks of Massachusetts as citizens, right? So Justice Curtis, according to Justice Curtis, Taney's reading of the Constitution is incorrect on its own terms. And indeed, Taney's mischaracterization of the status of blacks in American life would prompt Frederick Douglass in May of 1857 to denounce the Dred Scott decision as, quote, a most scandalous and devilish perversion of the Constitution, a brazen misstatement of the facts of history. That's the full quote. But just imagine. Brother stands up and says, this is the most scandalous and devilish perversion of the Constitution. And he's speaking to the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court. But he wasn't the only one that condemned it. Future President and lawyer Abraham Lincoln, that same summer, would condemn the Dred Scott decision for the reasons we just talked about. It was obvious to everyone who was able to read the law at the time that the court had shown little integrity and respect for the rule of law. The tragic impulse towards racism and pro-slavery nationalism had destroyed the court's presumption of impartiality and, along with it, its credibility as a legal institution. That's what happened. Okay, so the aftermath, right? So the court declares the Scott family to be slaves. That decision simultaneously infuriates the abolitionists. It emboldens would-be secessionists to take even stronger pro-slavery measures, and that's what leads to the Civil War. In the meantime, what's up with Dred and Harriet? Dred and Harriet become local heroes in St. Louis. Eventually, Mrs. Emerson, now Chafee, agrees to transfer title of the Scotts to the Blow family. Remember? The ones that financed Dred Scott's legal fees, they're still involved. She says, okay, I'm willing to sell the family for whatever money Dred Scott had earned during the time that he was working. He'd been basically hired out to the sheriff's office in St. Louis to work for the decade, right, while all this litigation was pending. So she goes, I want the proceeds, whatever he earned, but then after that, you can have them, right? Because now, how old is Dred Scott? It's 1857. He's 57 years old. $750 is what Dred Scott earned. So the Scotts are sold to the Blow family for $750. Blows free Dred and his family. Dred would live for two more years as a free man. He worked as a porter at the Barnum Hotel in St. Louis. Harriet worked as a laundress at the same hotel. She would die about 9 years later. During that period, she worked tirelessly to keep those daughters out of the media spotlight, out of the press. Following the Civil War, we get the ratification of the 13th Amendment, the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1866, which was a precursor to the 14th Amendment. So you abolish slavery, you establish equal citizenship for everybody, regardless of race. That effectively overrules the Dred Scott decision. Justice Taney, his reputation as well as the court, was in shambles. Taney died a bitter old man on the wrong side of history I actually have a portrait of Justice Taney in my office at the law school. And whenever I teach this case, I always bring the portrait out and I set it up in front of the classroom just so people can look at this broken man.
So what do they say?
They can't believe what they see. I mean, they see a man who was at the top of his game, right? You're talking about the chief judge of the United States Supreme Court, highest court in the land, wrote some of the most influential opinions in this nation's history, and the worst one. And what you see in his face is remorse and regret. That's what you see in his face. Yes, there are. And this explains why there's such controversy associated with those monuments, with his bust at the Maryland State House in Annapolis, and why the one in Frederick back in October was defaced, right? They spray painted that thing. And here's what's interesting, right? Taney was a staunch advocate of pro-slavery nationalism. And that died with the Confederacy. And I think people are realizing now that the legacy of Justice Taney should be remembered, but perhaps not celebrated. Before, we had celebrated him as a great Marylander. Now, I think we remember him for what he did, as opposed to celebrate. Okay, so I want to close with some thoughts about the kinds of lessons that we might draw from the Dred Scott decision and, you know, things that are relevant to today, because it's bad, I think, to leave history in the past. So let's talk about a few lessons. First, there's the institutional lesson. It's a cautionary tale, this case is, about the appropriate role of the court in American society. We often think of judicial activism as having a liberal valence, right? When you ever hear, you know, activist judge, it's usually a liberal activist, right? But Dred Scott, I think, corrects that historical narrative, because Dred Scott, perhaps the most reviled case of judicial activism, was unabashedly conservative, right? This is a states' rights case, right? But there's a second lesson, and this one is a little bit more nuanced, right? Namely, that sometimes it's best to leave political decisions, particularly controversial ones, to the political process, right? We've had the luxury of basking in the reflected glow of the Warren Court era, of judicial decision making, where we can put a controversial question to the court, like Brown versus Board of Education, and have the court strike down segregation, right? Or we can have, you know, the right to counsel. Put that before the court will say, yes, you have a right to counsel, right? That's where you take controversial questions and the Supreme Court decides them, and typically decides them in a way that puts to rest a lot of the fighting and the dispute. Roe versus Wade is another one, right? Controversial cases that are decided by a court, political questions. But that doesn't always work. Dred Scott is a cautionary tale that sometimes if the court reaches out and tries to decide a controversial question, it can backfire. And so sometimes it's best to use the political process to resolve political questions, unless there's reason to think that the political process cannot be trusted. Okay, second, there is a conceptual lesson here, namely that there's some distance between the language and the text of our founding documents, like the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, and how that gets translated into real life. I think the Dred Scott case reveals a certain paradox of principle of American democracy, that there's this commitment to freedom and equality for all that's been written in all of our texts, and then there are devastating modes of permanent racial oppression for some people. Taney was unapologetic in laying bare this fundamental contradiction. And I think many people simply could not stomach seeing it so openly. Yet the contradiction endured and continues to operate today just beneath the surface. I mean, it's this essential contradiction explains why Jim Crow was able to flourish despite constitutional language guaranteeing equality. It explains why the majority of people incarcerated today are people of color. Why racial minorities continue to lag behind whites in every, not nearly every, in every index of socioeconomic well-being. So the gap still exists, this inherent contradiction. I think we need to continue to work to try to close that gap between our text and our reality, right? The text is aspirational, but we still have to press to try to reach that aspiration. Okay, third, There is an important legal legacy to note, namely that the court's forceful rejection of black citizenship is what provided the impetus for the Civil Rights Act of 1866 and the 14th Amendment, both of which radically affirm equal citizenship. Know that the Civil Rights Act of 1866 is actually an important piece of legislation today. If you read Courtland Malloy's column this morning, he mentioned it. There was a lawsuit that was filed by a black bartender in a bar at Red Line, not too far from here, right? She was discriminated against, right, on the basis of her race. She filed her claim under the Civil Rights Act of 1866, the first piece of civil rights legislation that was designed to overturn Dred Scott. So there's an important legacy there, right, that we continue to rely upon. These are key pieces of legislation by which we secure racial redress. Finally, there's the cultural legacy, namely that this case, I think, makes clear that the struggle for citizenship and later civil rights was and is about the desire to be treated with equal dignity, to be viewed as possessing equal humanity. And what's most moving, I think, about the Dred Scott decision is the dignity with which the Scott family carried themselves throughout this decade-long ordeal, despite the court's best efforts to deprive them of that dignity. Ultimately, it's Dred and Harriet and Eliza and Lizzie who gained the respect of a nation, and it's the inhumanity of the court and the institution of slavery that's laid bare for all to see. And the salience of this point has not been lost on subsequent generations. It's no surprise that the hashtag Black Lives Matter movement emerged just a few yards from where Dred Scott is buried. St. Louis, Missouri. The epic pursuit of human dignity carried out in such dramatic fashion by the Scots has been resurrected and reborn in the 21st century struggle for racial justice.
Of the Dred Scott decision.
And it's amazing to see young people carry on.
Is exposed the institution of slavery, exposed the institution of racism, which this country basically was founded on. You know, stealing the land from the people who were already here and saying that they discovered America, and then the not getting any rights according to the system that they have set up, which is a racist system, racism, white supremacy, and all the rules that go with that, all because of a color of a man's skin. The South was mad because when Lincoln freed the slaves, then that went their labor. So they made deals. You ever heard of the Emancipation Act? Look that up. That's where the slave owners, who when Lincoln freed the slaves, were given $300 per each slave that they lost. But they told the slaves, you get 40 acres and a mule. You heard that before, but what you didn't hear is if you left the country. How about that? All these injustices. So you see all these protests that are going on, not only here, but worldwide, because this system of racism, white supremacy is worldwide. Okay, I'm getting a signal there. What is that, a minute, 2 minutes? All righty, 1 minute to go. Okay, that's it. Okay. All right, this has been Point West here on TalkTainmentRadio.com. We'll see you in a couple of weeks. Thanks for listening.
The power, the world's greatest radio, TalkTainmentRadio.com.